Good afternoon, this is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. It's the night before the show and I'm recording this and it's a bit hot. Hot for us anyway, but I lived in Bangkok for a year and even their lows are most often hot, higher than our highs. So this is not bothering me too much. What caused the heat? It's the sun. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the sun. There's apparently some kind of solar storm coming towards us. It will apparently hit us on Thursday. And let's talk about another object we see in the sky a lot. It's the moon. I was talking last week about the Sturgeon supermoon, or the full moon. And there's some facts that I learned, like the moon rotates on a plane 5 degrees above the plane of rotation that we thought it would be. I'm making a mess of this, aren't I? So if you take the plane that we thought the moon rotated on, it's 5 degrees above that. So that's why we can see the moon so clearly like that sometimes. So I'm talking about the Sturgeon supermoon. And I was talking about, well, you can see it here, you can see it there, and at this time. And then I thought later, why am I talking about this? A full moon is boring, and that's what the article said last week. You can't really see anything. It's so bright, it just reflects all the light back onto you. And let's say if the moon is at a different phase, half phase or quarter phase, whatever, then you look along the terminator, the line that divides the night and day, or the light and the dark on the moon, then you can see beautiful craters. So you can't really see anything on the moon. You can't see craters when it's at a full moon. And I was thinking, well, why am I talking about it? Because I basically think the full moon's boring, but this was a supermoon. And the only time I think it's not boring is when it's close to the horizon. That's when it looks really big. But yeah, it was kind of boring. So the supermoon was boring, like Donald Trump's two sun, which they're showing on TV now. So the supermoon was boring, and just a big bright moon in the sky. And I watched it a couple nights, a little bit, just looked up, and there's nothing you can see. But as I said, when it's at a different phase, you can take your binoculars and really get to see it. But what happened is the supermoon happened during the Perseids meteor shower, so it was harder to see the meteors. But I talked to a woman that I know the next day, and she said she saw some of the meteor showers and they looked very nice. And when I went to Hawaii, on top of their big mountain on the island of Hawaii, there was a full moon, so you couldn't see the Milky Way as well as you could see without the full moon. So then I said I planned my trip to Hawaii without realizing I was arriving when there was a full moon. So now I can be smarter about that. Sometimes when I go on these astronomy trips, just like when I went to the LIGO Observatory in Washington, I arrived there with my hotshot recorder, which had 1 or 2 gigs of storage on its chip. And who uses a 1 or 2 gig storage chip anymore? I should have had 20, 30 or higher. So anyway, sometimes I'm not planning my astronomical trips very well. And I went to the Lowell Observatory, and I knew I was going to go into Arizona. And I think the city's called Flagstaff, so the Lowell Observatory, that's where they first discovered Pluto. And I didn't plan my trip well because I arrived at night, and then I didn't think, and I think it was a weekend, and I didn't get to go inside the observatory. So sometimes when I'm planning my trips, I'm not doing so at a great time. So sometime at the proper time. So now I talked about the supermoon, and there was nothing interesting to see about the supermoon, just that it was bigger. And maybe if somebody saw close to the horizon, then it might be interesting. But another interesting thing is our sun. Our beautiful sun is basking us in heat, which is very nice, isn't it? But now there's apparently a storm coming our way from the sun, and it will arrive on August 18, which is Thursday when the show will be playing. I'm speaking now late night Wednesday, on the 17th. August 18th will when the plasma plume will slam into the earth. So I'm going to read about this, the plasma plume. And a bit later, I'm going to talk about one of my favorite stars, Betelgeuse. Everybody loves Betelgeuse from the movie and stuff. So I am going to talk about the changes occurring in Betelgeuse. And I keep looking up to see where Betelgeuse is and hoping it will finally show us a supernova. It could have already gone supernova, but it's 500 light years away. So if it went supernova today, we'll know about it in about 500 years. So here is about the, I think, supernova 1987A. What happened before people on Earth saw it? A bunch of neutrinos came before we could see it, and it could have been a couple hours before we saw it. So if Betelgeuse ever does go supernova in our lifetime, then all of a sudden maybe we'll detect a bunch of neutrinos coming at us, or more neutrinos, and then a few hours, a few days later, bang, there'll be our superstar Betelgeuse exploding. So that's what we're all waiting for. And the supernova 1987A, I believe it happened, the Small Magellanic Cloud, which is something like 180,000 light years away, or it could be 180 million light years away. I'll look that up during the break. But Betelgeuse is much closer. So anyway, I'll talk about Betelgeuse a bit later. First, I'm going to talk about the CME, the coronal mass ejection. And this is an article from LiveScience.com. And I actually went to NASA.gov because there was nothing interesting on LiveScience.com. So there was a couple of stories like this one, but not really some attention-grabbing stories like there are sometimes. So here goes. Cannibal coronal mass ejection from dark plasma plume will slam into Earth tomorrow, August 18th. So it's called a cannibal coronal mass ejection, so we'll see why it's called cannibal. This was published today by Ben Turner. So the storm is classified as strong, but isn't expected to cause much disruption. And last week I talked about certain scales when you can measure the strength of solar storms coming at us. And they were all over the place. I looked at different authors and they said it seemed different things. Because I thought C1, C2, C3, C4 was the limit of it. But one person said it goes up to C5, another one goes C9. So for example, on if it's a scale of 1 to 9, then 9 would be the strongest one and the most dangerous one, and 1 would be the least dangerous. Here is G3, so they're calling it G3. Okay, a plume of dark plasma hurled from the sun will be engulfed to form a cannibal coronal mass ejection, which will sideswipe the Earth on Thursday, August 18th, causing a strong G3 geomagnetic storm. The dark plasma explosion was first spotted by solar observers on Sunday, August 14th, as it erupted from a sunspot on the sun's surface at a speed of roughly 1.3 million miles per hour, or 2.1 million kilometers per hour, tearing through the sun's atmosphere, creating a coronal mass ejection, CME, or explosive jets of solar material, spaceweather.com wrote. Then on Monday, August 15th, another CME created by the collapse of a gigantic magnetic filament was launched from the sun. Sunspots are areas on the sun's surface where powerful magnetic fields created by the flow of electrical charges knot into kinks before suddenly snapping. The resulting release of energy launches bursts of radiation called solar flares, or plumes of solar material called coronal mass ejections. CMEs can also be launched by the collapse of unstable solar filaments, which are huge suspended tubes of electrified gas or plasma that worm their way through the sun's atmosphere according to the whim of the star's magnetic field. Okay. Now here's a related story. Strange new type of solar wave defies physics. Okay, I possibly could read that later, but I'm going to keep on with this story. The two eruptions together will merge to form a cannibal coronal mass ejection, according to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, forecast. Cannibal CMEs occur when one fast-moving solar eruption overtakes an earlier eruption in the same region of space, gobbling up the charged particles to form a giant combined wavefront that, upon reaching Earth, triggers a powerful geomagnetic storm. Oh, so that's what a cannibal is. A big one overtakes a smaller one and eats it alive, so it's a cannibal one. The cannibal CME is no different. When it arrives at Earth, the dark plasma plume, so named because of its comparatively cooler, darker appearance, will cause a G3 geomagnetic storm. Geomagnetic storms occur when planets with strong magnetic fields like our own absorb the high-speed barrage of solar debris from CMEs. During these storms, Earth's magnetic field gets compressed slightly by waves of highly energetic particles. These particles trickle down magnetic field lines near the poles and agitate molecules in the atmosphere, releasing energy in the form of light to create colorful auroras, similar to the ones that make up the northern lights. Geomagnetic storms are classified from G1 to G5. See, last week I thought it was G1 to G4, and another classification system said no, they're classified from G1 to G9, or was it C1 to C9? But anyway, there's a lot of classifications, like C, X, A, depending on how strong they are, and numbers 1 to maybe 9. Okay, geomagnetic storms are classified from G1 to G5 according to their severity. G3 storms are strong geomagnetic storms, meaning that the upcoming sunblast could bring the dazzling aurora as far south as Illinois and Oregon, where we are. We're north of Oregon, so maybe we can see it. G3 storms can cause intermittent problems for low frequency and satellite navigation, increasing drag on low Earth orbit satellites, and may require some power systems to make voltage connections, according to the CWPC. Right now I have to interject here because I'm sitting on my table. It's almost midnight and I'm getting nice gusts of wind. So we know it's a bit hot today, and what I did is I froze a nice container of water, then I poured some cold water into that, and I had such a nice drink. And I was just starting to drink it, and then bang, I knocked it on the floor. So my coronal mass ejection, I was so unhappy with that because, you know, we want nice, cool drinks. But anyway, most extreme geomagnetic storms can disrupt our planet's magnetic field powerfully enough to send satellites tumbling. And scientists have warned that extreme geomagnetic storms could even cripple the internet. Wow. And as I say all the time, you know, our scientists are great in Canada. They're some of the top scientists in the world, and they work so hard, and they won Nobel Prizes. But we just don't get the type of funding that America gets. So when all this news comes from certain websites in America about these geomagnetic storms and a lot of topics about astronomy, they are, you think, well, Canada doesn't have a space weather website. Canada doesn't have satellites and things to monitor the storms from the sun. So we got to thank the U.S. for doing these things, because, as it says, a severe magnetic or geomagnetic storm could send satellites tumbling to Earth and could also cripple the internet. So I'm always impressed on how much things they do in space and how much research they do in astronomy. This storm comes as the sun ramps into its most active phase of its roughly 11-year-long solar cycle. Astronomers have known since 1775 that solar activity rises and falls in cycle, but recently the sun has been more active than expected, with nearly double the sunspot appearances predicted by NOAA. Scientists anticipate that the sun's activity will steadily climb for the next few years, reaching an overall maximum in 2025 before decreasing again. A paper published July 20 in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics proposed a new model of the sun's activity by separately counting sunspots in each hemisphere, a method the paper's researchers argue could be used to make more accurate solar forecasts. Scientists think the largest solar storm ever witnessed during contemporary history was the 1859 Carrington event, which released roughly the same energy as 10 billion 1 megaton atomic bombs. After slamming into Earth, the powerful stream of solar particles fried telegraph systems all over the world and caused auroras brighter than the light of the full moon to appear as far south as the Caribbean. If a similar event were to happen today, scientists warn, it would cause trillions of dollars in damage and trigger widespread blackouts, much like the 1989 solar storm that had released a billion ton plume of gas and caused a blackout across the entire Canadian province of Quebec, NASA reported. So I'm wondering how scientists have figured out how to mitigate against this disaster happening. So they monitor and they could warn us that things are coming, but I really don't know the effects of the solar storm. So that would be an interesting thing to know, but I don't know if they do or not. I'm just going to go a little bit back here and talk about this little link that websites like livescience.com and space.com have, but for some reason my computer is being a heel. It is it's not cooperating now. It's going very slow and I just cannot get it to go up to the link that I wanted. So here it is. Okay. So I overdid it and now I went above the link. Now I'm going to go down and see if I can catch that link. There's something about solar storms. So please be patient. I'm just working with my technology, which I have at home, which is a piece of junk computer. Oh, here we go. Maybe it's here. I really want to see this link because sometimes they're linked. Okay, now here's another one. Here's the link. Is this related? Strange new type of solar wave defies physics. So on a similar note, I could say similar because it's about technology and how it has intruded into our life or runs our life, or without this technology we'd be lost, wouldn't we? So we're talking about cell phones, and one friend of mine says, I don't know how I could ever do without my cell phone. And I had my cell phone stolen a couple of weeks ago by somebody who I thought was a friend. And I'm kind of loving it. I'm not always being pulled to the screen where I got to see who's texting me or messaging me on my... So it's kind of nice to be without it. But anyway, here, strange new type of solar wave defies physics. It is by Ben Turner, published March 25th, 2022, and the findings hit at undiscovered solar physics. I think there's, like, for example, a piano has a certain amount of keys. Inside the sun, there's like 700, I guess I could say, keys or classification of the waves that bounce around inside the sun. And from these waves, scientists, astronomers can learn things about the inside of the sun by studying these waves. So anyway, here's the article. It is called A Strange New Type of Solar Wave Defies Physics. Scientists have detected a strange new type of high-frequency wave on the sun's surface, and the waves are moving three times faster than scientists thought was possible. The acoustic waves, called high-frequency retrograde, or HFR vorticity waves, were spotted... Could I make a joke? No, I'm not. I was going to make a joke, but forget it. We're spotted rippling backward through the sun's plasma in the opposite direction of its rotation. The previously unknown type of wave was described in a study published March 24th in the journal Nature Astronomy. Scientists can't see into the sun's fiery depths, so they often measure the acoustic waves that move across its surface and bounce back towards the core to infer what's going on inside. But the unprecedented speed of the HFR waves, spotted in 25 years of data from space and ground-based telescopes, has hinted that scientists might be missing something big. Let's see what they're missing. So says University of Abu Dhabi Center for Space Physics, an astronomer called Shravan Hanasogi said, in quote, "The very existence of HFR modes and their origin is a true mystery and may allude to exciting physics at play. It has the potential to shed insight on the otherwise unobservable interior of the sun," end quote. Now here's a movie, let's see, it told me the title and then it didn't tell me. It disappeared, so I'm not going to play it. Scientists initially thought that acoustic solar waves formed near the sun's surface thanks to the Coriolis effect, in which points on a rotating sphere's equator seem to move faster than points on its poles. Once the waves form, scientists think one of three possible processes could accelerate them into HFR waves. Either the sun's magnetic field or its gravity could be boosting the Coriolis waves, or super hot convection currents moving under and across its surface could be dragging them to unprecedentedly high speeds, but none of these possible processes fit the data. Okay, it says scientists think one of three possible processes could accelerate the HFR waves, but it only gave two possibilities. Either the sun's magnetic field or its gravity could be boosting the Coriolis effect, or Coriolis waves, or super hot convection currents moving under and across the surface could be dragging them to unprecedented high speed. So there they give two possible processes and they say three. Okay, anyway. So says author Chris Hansen, a solar physicist at New York University Abu Dhabi Center for Space Science. And quote, "If the HR waves could be attributed to any of these three processes," but they gave two, "then the finding would have answered some open questions we still have about the sun. However, these new waves don't appear to be a result of either of these processes, and that's exciting because it leads to a whole new set of questions. Filling the gaps in their knowledge might help the researchers better understand the sun's interior, as well as get a better sense of how the sun affects Earth and other planets in the solar system. Could also give insight into a similar type of high-frequency wave called the Rossby wave, that's Rossby, which has been seen transversing Earth's oceans four times faster than current models can explain." Interesting. So we can all, says, once the wave forms, there are three possible processes that could accelerate them into HFR waves. So gives two, though. Either the sun's magnetic field, maybe that's one, or its gravity could be boosting the Coriolis wave, so that's one and two, maybe. Or super hot convection currents moving under and across its surface could be dragging them to unprecedentedly high speeds. So that's interesting how here we saw, okay, accelerating the waves to super high speeds, and it also happens on the ocean. Okay, so now we've talked about our buddy the sun, and we're going to talk more astronomy after I take a break. So I'm going to take a break now. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. And I guess we can say the topic I talked about in the first part was astrophysics. So now I'm going to go in that direction again. I'm going to talk about astrophysics. So we're going to talk about Betelgeuse. And one of my favorite stars, Betelgeuse, is probably the second most studied star after our sun. So people have studied it a lot, and let's see what's happening with Betelgeuse. So one of the brightest stars in the sky dimmed in 19. One of the brightest stars in the sky dimmed in 2019. Now we don't know why. Published by Stephanie Pappas, published 6 days ago, which is like something like August the 12th, last Friday. So the subtitle says, "Part of the star went kablooey." So it shows here real life pictures, and it says the four panel graphic illustrates how the southern region of the rapidly evolving bright red supergiant star Betelgeuse may have suddenly become fainter for several months during late 2019 and early 2020. In the first two panels, as seen in ultraviolet light with the Hubble Space Telescope, a bright hot blob of plasma is ejected from the emergence of a huge convection cell on the star's surface. In panel 3, the outflowing expelled gas rapidly expands outward. It cools to form an enormous cloud of obscuring dust grains. The final panel reveals the huge dust cloud blocking the light as seen from Earth from a quarter of the star's surface. Okay, so if you can see this, it looks quite spectacular. It shows the little first panel, a little light starting to emerge from the star, and the second one shows a bigger one called Bluey. Third one, it shows the dust being ejected, and the fourth one shows the dust settling in front of the star, so we can't see it very well. Okay, here goes the article. The star Betelgeuse visibly dimmed in 2019. Now a new analysis reveals why Betelgeuse blew out and is still recovering. The red supergiant star, which is about 530 light years from Earth, is among the brightest in the night sky. The star forms the shoulder of the constellation Orion, the Hunter. It's also geriatric. Betelgeuse is nearing the end of its stellar life and will eventually explode in a supernova visible from Earth, though it might take another 100,000 years, according to 2021 research. But it might happen tomorrow, so we don't know. I think Betelgeuse is like 5 or 7 million years old, maybe 10 at the most. So it's ripe to blow apart. In late 2019, Betelgeuse's light started to dim. By February 2020, it had lost two-thirds of its normal luminosity as seen from Earth. Scientists studying the bizarre dimming concluded that the star itself was not imminently going supernova, but that a giant dust cloud had obscured some of the star's surface. And here's a related link. It says bright star Betelgeuse might be harboring a deep dark secret. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Wow. Now, scientists using the Hubble Space Telescope have revealed that this dust cloud was the result of enormous ejection from the star's surface, a plume more than 1 million miles or 1.6 million kilometers across may have risen from inside the star, producing the equivalent of a starquake, a shock that blew out a chunk of the star's surface, 400 million times larger than those usually seen in the sun's coronal mass ejections. 400 million times larger than our sun's. Wow. The teams reported in a paper published to the preprint database ARXIV. So says Andrea Dupree, Associate Director of the Harvard and Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and quote, Betelgeuse continues doing some very unusual things right now. The interior is sort of bouncing. This is uncharted territory in star science. We've never before seen a huge mass ejection of the surface of a star. We are left with something going on that we don't completely understand. It's a totally new phenomenon that we can observe directly and resolve surface details with Hubble. We're watching stellar evolution in real time. Very exciting. To me it is, anyway. The new research also incorporated information from a variety of other stellar observatories, such as the Stella Robotic Observatory in Spain's Canary Islands. I never heard of Stella before. And NASA's Earth Orbiting Stereo A spacecraft. I've heard of that. By piecing together different types of data, Dupree and her team were able to put together a narrative of the blowout and its aftermath. The eruption blew off a chunk of the star's lower atmosphere, the photosphere, leaving behind a cool spot that was further occluded by the dust cloud from the blowout. The chunk of photosphere was several times the mass of Earth's moon, according to NASA. This cool spot and dust cloud explain why Betelgeuse's light dimmed. The star is still feeling the reverberations. Before the eruption, Betelgeuse had a pulsing pattern, dimming and brightening on a 400-day cycle. That cycle is now gone, at least temporarily. It's possible that the convection cells inside the star are still sloshing around, disrupting the pattern the researchers found. The star's outer atmosphere may be back to normal, but its surface may still be jiggling like jello. The eruption isn't evidence that Betelgeuse will go supernova anytime soon, the researcher said, but it does show how old stars lose mass. If Betelgeuse does finally die in a stellar explosion, the light will be visible in the daytime from Earth, but the star is too far away to have any other impacts on our planet. Good. Okay. So, what was I going to say? It's jiggling like jello. And, oh yeah, what I was going to say is, our sun is losing mass every day, and Betelgeuse is losing mass every day. Especially Betelgeuse, it's dying, it's getting bigger, and it's doing some weird stuff now that people don't understand. But that's one of the great things about, we don't understand something, then we are going to look into it and discover something new. And that's what science, I think, should be all about, or is all about. So this next thing I'm going to read is about Betelgeuse. It says, bright star Betelgeuse might be harboring a deep, dark secret, by Adam Mann, published January 8, 2020. A new model suggests that the star Betelgeuse committed an act of cannibalism. Wow. Okay, this is in Honolulu. The story is from Honolulu. The giant red star Betelgeuse might be harboring... You know what, I'm going to stop this now because it's something I wanted to say last time and I forgot to say it. And if I don't say it now, then I might forget to say it. So this is about the Webb Space Telescope. And an astronomer, I watched NASA TV last week, and an astronomer said, one of the wonderful things about Hubble is we verified a lot of the things that scientists wanted to verify. They were asking questions, and some of their theories were verified, and they were looking for things that they wanted to find, and then they found those things. So, and one of the great things about Hubble was about 50% of its discoveries were things that no one had a clue that they would discover. So that's one of the great things about what's going to happen with Webb, I guess, is there's a lot of things that astronomers have wanted to do with Webb, and they're putting their experiments up there, but then there's going to be a lot of things, maybe 50% of the things that they find are things that they never knew that they would discover. So that's one of the exciting things that made Hubble so great, is about half of its discoveries were like, whoa, we didn't know that, and we didn't think that would happen. So that's what's going to happen with Webb. Okay, so now back to this article. I'm sorry, I had to say it because I forgot to say it last time. So bright star Betelgeuse might be harboring a deep, dark secret, published January 8, 2020 by Adam Mann, and a new model suggests that the star Betelgeuse committed an act of cannibalism. So this is in Honolulu. That's what the story comes from. So I guess it was up in those peaks that they discovered the thing that they're going to talk about now. The giant red star Betelgeuse might be harboring a gruesome secret in its past. A new model posits that the prominent night sky object was once two stars until the larger star ate its smaller companion, and that could explain several of Betelgeuse's peculiar properties. Betelgeuse is a whopper of a star with a diameter of 600 million miles or 965 million kilometers, bigger than the orbit of Mars. At a relatively close distance of 520 light years from Earth, Betelgeuse is also one of the few stars whose surface features can be resolved with telescopes. By closely monitoring Betelgeuse's surface, different researchers have calculated that the star's rotational rate is somewhere between 11,000 and 33,000 miles per hour. Manos Chatzopoulos, an astronomer at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, said during a session Monday, January 6th at the 235th meeting of the American Astronomical Society here. This is surprising because as the star ages and enters the red giant phase of its life, like Betelgeuse has, the star expands and its rotation typically slows, much like an ice skater pushing out their arms to slow their spin. Betelgeuse is also a runaway star, meaning that the object is zipping along at a mind-boggling speed, in Betelgeuse's case 67,000 miles per hour, or 108,000 kilometers per hour, relative to background stars in the Milky Way. I wish they would have given us some data to compare it with the Sun. A lot of you astronomers might remember this, but I don't remember the diameter or the radius of the Sun. So says Chatzopoulos, and quote, "For such a famous star that everyone knows and loves, no one has tried to explain the combination of these two things," end quote. And Chatzopoulos referred to its odd rotation rate and speed. So how do you put these together? How do you put these two facts together? A clue might come from Betelgeuse. Is thought to originate a star dense region known as the Orion OB1A Association. Along with colleagues, Chatzopoulos has suggested that gravitational interactions with many stars in that region could have flung Betelgeuse away at high speeds of millions of years ago, explaining the star's hypervelocity. So imagine if the Sun was in the middle of all that collection of stars. Wow. Betelgeuse might have also been a smaller companion, the researchers posited, which got tossed out along with it. As Betelgeuse aged and expanded, it might have engulfed its partner, which would have stirred up Betelgeuse's outer layers, like stirring up coffee with a stick, Chatzopoulos said, and increased its rotation rate. He and his collaborators have run sophisticated stellar evolution computer models incorporating all these ideas. The results that best fit Betelgeuse's observed features suggested it was once two separate stars, one with 16 times the Sun's mass and the other with 4 times the Sun's mass. The researchers are preparing to submit their research to the Astrophysical Journal. The researchers' models were also able to match the amount of nitrogen seen in Betelgeuse's atmosphere, which is unusually high. This is a potentially corroborating piece of evidence because the stirring of a companion star might have dredged up nitrogen from Betelgeuse's center, Chatzopoulos said. Earlier work by Chatzopoulos's former PhD advisor offered the idea that Betelgeuse was formed as the merger of two stars. Chatzopoulos said that his new research expands on that prior idea and adds in specific simulations to account for the red giant's rotation and speed. So says Andrea Dupree, a senior astrophysicist at Harvard, and quote, "I think it's interesting," end quote. Wow, what a quote! referring to colleagues previously proposed that Betelgeuse may have swallowed exoplanetary companions. But she said it would be useful to take a closer look at Betelgeuse's properties, some of which haven't been measured in as long as 30 years, before saying anything definitive. Betelgeuse has lately been in the news over the possibility that it could imminently burst as a spectacular supernova. So Chatzopoulos' research provide the new explanation of Betelgeuse's birth? Does it mean anything about the star's death? I don't know. Chatzopoulos doesn't have an answer to that, but if his idea is correct, he said it could mean Betelgeuse was rejuvenated at some point in the past with fresh material from the companion that the star consumed. That could have led scientists to underestimate Betelgeuse's age, meaning it's not set to explode anytime soon. As an astronomer specializing in supernovas, he finds this perhaps a bit disappointing, because he says, in quote, "All of us who study supernova wish it would happen in our lifetime," end quote. And I wish that too. I wish that Betelgeuse would go supernova. I think about that often when I look up and see Betelgeuse in the sky. And I'm saying, please, please go supernova. I would love to see that. Okay, so now we talked a little bit about stars and astrophysics. So I'm going to go for a break. And I'm thinking maybe I should continue on in astrophysics. But then I was so intrigued by this Artemis 1 moon launch that I'm going to probably talk about that. We'll see. But anyway, this is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I'm going to go for a break. And when I come back, we'll talk more astronomy.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam Nisiaya,
Anthasyakuya, Talitin, Homasquimasteo. Welcome back to AstroTalk. I'm Marco. Now I'm going to talk first, I'm going to talk a little bit about Voyager because it celebrated a birthday. And then I'll probably go to this Artemis 1 launch. So this article is dated August 17, 2022. It's on NASA.gov, and the name of the article is Voyager, NASA's longest-lived mission, logs 45 years in space. So, it says at the top of it, NASA TV, so later I'm going to go to NASA TV and see if it has a program about Voyager. Okay, so here's an image of Voyager, and it says, this archival image taken at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory on March 23, 1977, shows engineers preparing the Voyager 2 spacecraft ahead of its launch later that year. Launched in 1977, the twin Voyager probes are NASA's longest operating mission and the only spacecraft ever to explore interstellar space. So here, if you go to this article, it says, here's a subsection, see a gallery of archival photos and highlights from the Voyager mission. Next one is an interactive lifetime of Voyager's 45-year mission, and read the story of the people behind Voyager, and it says watch a visualization of Voyager's trajectory through the solar system. Now that would be fun. Okay, I've said this often before, but I've talked to an astronomer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a scientist, Trina Ray, and what happened is she worked on the Voyager mission, I believe, for quite a few years, and then she worked on the Cassini mission, and now she's going to work on the Clipper mission, which is sending, I believe it's to Europa, they're going to send a probe, and they're going to look at things about the water under Europa's surface, and I don't know if it's this mission, but one of the missions that they want to do is put a submarine under the water there and let it do its biz, so that would be fun. Okay, so again, this article is called Voyager, NASA's longest-lived mission, logs 45 years in space. Hooray, happy birthday. NASA's twin Voyager probes have become, in some ways, time capsules of their era. They each carry an 8-track tape player, imagine 8-track tape player, for recording data. They have about 3 million times less memory than modern cell phones, and they transmit data about 38,000 times slower than a 5G internet connection. Yet the Voyagers remain on the cutting edge of space exploration. Managed and operated by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California, they are the only probes to ever explore interstellar space, the galactic ocean that our sun and its planets travel through. So I think there was a double spacecraft system, Frontier or something like that, sent into interstellar space, and I think before Voyager, because I think scientists wanted to know if spacecraft could actually travel through the asteroid belt. That's what I recall, so I don't have the facts right in front of me. So there is another one, and they lost contact with those, but those still might be going into interstellar space, so we don't know. The suns and the planet reside in the heliosphere, a protective bubble created by the sun's magnetic field and the outward flow of solar wind, charged particles from the sun. Researchers, some of them younger than the two distant spacecraft, are combining Voyager's observations with data from newer missions to get a more complete picture of our sun and how the heliosphere interacts with interstellar space. I think the heliosphere is the limit of Sun's atmosphere. So says Nicola Fox, director of the Heliophysics Division at NASA's headquarters in Washington, and quote, "The heliophysics mission fleet provides invaluable insights into our sun, from understanding the corona of the outermost part of the sun's atmosphere to examining the sun's impacts throughout the solar system, including here on Earth, in our atmosphere, and on into interstellar space. Over the last 45 years, the Voyager missions have been integral in providing this knowledge and have helped change our understanding of the sun and its influences in ways no other spacecraft can." Very exciting stuff. Voyagers are also ambassadors, each carrying a golden record containing images of life on Earth. I'm wondering, what if aliens find the spacecraft and they look inside and there's 8-track tapes and a golden record, and they'll think, where did these Stone Age people come from? Because they're probably much more advanced. And they contain diagrams of basic scientific principles and audio that includes sounds from nature, greetings in multiple languages, and music. The gold-coated records serve as a cosmic message in a bottle for anyone who might encounter the space probes. As the rate gold decays in space and is eroded by cosmic radiation, the records will last more than a billion years. Great. Beyond expectations. Voyager 2 launched on August 20, 1977, quickly followed by Voyager 1 on September 5th. Both probes traveled to Jupiter and Saturn, with Voyager 1 moving faster and reaching them first. Together, the probes unveiled much about the solar system, two largest planets, and their moons. Voyager 2 also became the first and only spacecraft to fly close to Uranus in 1986 and Neptune in 1989, offering humanity remarkable views of and insights into these distant worlds. So here it shows, there's a little map. This is a really good article. If anybody is interested in Voyager, it says, "Voyager, NASA's longest lived mission, logs 45 years in space." And this is in nasa.gov. And here they have this beautiful photo that shows how the two spacecraft went to Jupiter and Saturn, and then how they diverged, how one of them went to Neptune and Uranus later, and the other ones went straight out of the into interstellar space. So here's the caption under this photograph. It says, "Voyager 1 and 2 have accomplished a launch since they were launched in 1977. This infographic highlights the mission's major milestones, including visiting the four outer planets and exiting the heliosphere, or the protective bubble of magnetic fields and particles created by the sun." One thing I definitely am very interested in sometimes is the politics of these space missions. So I believe each of the Voyagers had enough funding for a 5-year mission, just like the probes that sent up to Mars have funding for 1 year or something, and then when they're successful, then they fund them more and more. And the scientists know when they're sending them out on these short missions that they're probably going to get funding. So it's great how their aircraft and their equipment, cameras and everything, exceed expectations, and they're out there. So Voyagers, if they've been out there for 45 years, I believe they only had a 5-year mission to start with. While Voyager 2 was conducted in the flybys, which was Uranus and Neptune, Voyager 1 headed towards the boundary of the heliosphere. Upon exiting it in 2012, Voyager 1 discovered that the heliosphere blocks 70% of cosmic rays, or energetic particles created by exploding stars. Voyager 2, after completing its planetary explorations, continued to the heliosphere boundary, exiting it in 2018, so 6 years later. The twin spacecraft's combined data from this region has challenged previous theories about the exact shape of the heliosphere. So says Linda Spilker, Voyager's deputy project scientist at JPL, and quote, "Today, as both Voyagers explore interstellar space, they are providing humanity with observations of uncharted territory. This is the first time we've been able to directly study how a star, our sun, interacts with the particles and magnetic fields outside our heliosphere, helping scientists understand the local neighborhood between the stars, upending some of the theories about this region, and providing key information for future missions. End quote. Now, I'm going to give an example of something I want to talk about now. So what I want to talk about was these scientists, Linda Spilker, and the other one that I talked about was Trina Ray, which I interviewed twice. So I would just love to be in a room with those two and other people that worked on Voyager, and I think Ed Stone was the manager of it all, and just listen to reminisce over memories about Voyager, things that we didn't even know about. And for example, one of the things I think was when people first went to the moon, I think it was Apollo 11, but I believe this was Apollo 10, when the astronauts first went up to the moon, they went around the moon. And what happened is, this was not common knowledge, but the trip around the far side of the moon, it was so fast and so terrifying that the astronauts threw up and soiled themselves, and there was all this excrement and vomit floating around the spacecraft. And they were scared. They were terrified. So NASA radioed up to them and says, after, on a secret radio, they said, let's cut this mission. I mean, this is not what we wanted. We don't want you guys to be terrified. And the astronauts said, no, we'll continue. But imagine, of all the scary stuff that could have happened that we don't know about, and to hear astronauts or people involved, astronomers involved in these projects, I would love, just like a sports talk show, just to gossip and gab and gab and gab. And there's other sports like, what's it called, The View with Whoopi Goldberg. They like to gossip and gab about things. And I'd love to hear Linda Tripp and, not Linda Tripp, oh my gosh, that was the person who informed of Monica Lewinsky. So I'm so sorry I brought up that name. Linda Spilker and Trina Ray. Oh my gosh, that's terrible. I'm very sorry about that. But anyway, I would love to hear Linda Spilker, Trina Ray, and some of the other scientists, Ed Stone, talking about, and just to pick their brain to ask them questions about this stuff. I would just love that. But anyway, here we go. So says Linda Spilker. Today, as both Voyagers explore interstellar space, they are providing humanity with observations of uncharted territory. And here's a, why not do this? I am going to play a video of Voyager.
Lifted off from Cape Canaveral atop Titan Centaur rockets. Traveling uninterrupted through interstellar space, the Voyagers will endure forever, long after everything man has ever built has crumbled into dust. In the event the spacecraft encounter alien intelligence, both Voyagers carry a copper phonograph record, a message, celebrating the sights and sounds of Earth.
And friendly wishes.
These unique discs contain photographs of everyday life, as well as voices, offering greetings in 55 languages. There are also animal noises, the music of Beethoven and Chuck Berry, a baby crying, laughter, rain, and a heartbeat. All of the planets in Voyager's path were in perfect alignment. Something that occurs only once every 176 years. The spacecraft were in position to visit all four of the outer planets. A grand slam. An interplanetary home run.
Well, that was great. It was nice to know about that. And as I said, it would be great to be able to pick the brain of somebody like Trina Ray, Linda Spilker, and just listen to them talking about Voyager. So here now, here's a subsection called The Long Journey. Over the years, the Voyager team has grown accustomed to surmounting challenges that come with operating such mature spacecraft, sometimes calling upon retired colleagues for their expense, for their expertise or digging through documents written years ago. Each Voyager is powered by a radioisotope thermoelectric generator containing plutonium, which gives off heat that is converted to electricity. As the plutonium decays, the heat output decreases and the Voyagers lose electricity. To compensate, the team turned off all non-essential systems and some once considered essential, including heaters that protect the still-operating instruments from the frigid temperatures of space. All five of the instruments that have had their heaters turned off since 2019 are still working, despite being well below the lowest temperatures that were ever tested at. So that's, again, one of the greatest things, is there are certain things that, what would I call them? Scientists, let's just call them scientists. They test their spacecraft, and then these spacecraft go well beyond their tested limits and still endure. So that's great. That's very great story to hear all these things. Recently, Voyager 1 began experiencing an issue that caused status information about one of its onboard systems to become garbled. Despite this, the system and spacecraft otherwise continue to operate normally, suggesting the problem is with the production of the status data, not the system itself. The probe is still sending back science observations while the engineering team tries to fix the problem or find a way to work around it. So remember, I think the power with which they send the signal is comparable to like a refrigerator light bulb, or even lower than that. So there I say billions of miles or kilometers away. So says Suzanne Dodd, project manager for Voyager at JPL, and quote, "The Voyagers have continued to make amazing discoveries, inspiring a new generation of scientists and engineers." So we should also say, like, Susan Dodd, a woman, is a project manager for Voyager. Linda Spilker is also a project manager. And Trina Ray, who I talked to, was the manager of some kind of system, and how she explained it to me was very complicated. So it's nice, I guess you can say more than nice, to see women making contributions at the highest levels of sciences. So I'll read that quote again. So says Susan Dodd, in quote, "The Voyagers have continued to make amazing discoveries, inspiring a new generation of scientists and engineers. We don't know how long the mission will continue, but we can be sure that the spacecraft will provide even more scientific surprises as they travel farther away from the Earth." So it's going to come up to 50 years pretty soon, then 100, then 200. I wonder how scientists 200 years from now, or 200 years from their launch, will view the Voyagers and the technology they had. More about the mission. A division of Caltech in Pasadena, JPL built and operates the Voyager spacecraft. The Voyager missions are part of the NASA Heliophysics System Observatory, sponsored by the Heliophysics Division of the Science Mission Directorate in Washington. For more information about the Voyager spacecraft, visit www.nasa.gov/Voyager. So that would be a great, great, great thing to visit this website. And I have a book about Voyager, just specifically about Voyager, and I have not read it as much as I should, so I'll try to do that. Now, I quickly want to finish off with this thing about the Artemis rocket. So here we go. Here it is. Don't have much time. I could probably spend more time on it. It says NASA's Voyager logs 45 years. I just clicked the exact same thing. So let's see. Okay, so here it is, Artemis 1. It says, "Join our virtual NASA social to experience the launch of the Artemis 1 mission." It's on NASA.gov. Social media users are invited to register to take part in our global virtual NASA social for the Artemis 1 launch of NASA's Space Launch System rocket carrying the Orion spacecraft from Space Launch Complex 39B at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. NASA is targeting launch on August 29th, so I can talk about that, this thing on next week's show, during a two-hour launch window that opens 8:33 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Artemis 1 will be an uncrewed flight test to send Orion around the moon and back to Earth over a six-week mission to check out systems before crew fly aboard on Artemis 2. Though through Artemis missions, NASA will land the first woman and the first person of color on the moon, paving the way for a long-term lunar presence and serving as a stepping stone to send astronauts to Mars. If your passion is to communicate and engage the world via social media, then this is the event for you. Seize the opportunity to blog, tweet, post, or simply share everything about the Artemis. Virtual NASA social participants will have the opportunity to 1. Connect virtually with a community of people excited about the Artemis 1 mission. 2. Watch exclusive behind-the-scenes videos about the mission. Those are interesting. 2. Obtain your own NASA social badge to share. 4. Learn more about the Orion spacecraft, the Space Launch System's rocket launching Artemis, and the mission objective. So, I think we had a pretty full show today, and I wanted to talk more about Artemis, but I could do that next week, because next week will be the day that I will probably talk just after Artemis was launched. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. Here's the thing. It says, can I register if I'm not a U.S. citizen? Yes. This is a global NASA social, and we would love you, for you to be a part of it. So let's see if I can join. So thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You have listened to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.